Leon Bellin spends his days inside a research lab trying to create artificial blood vessels. And several years ago, he made a discovery. The best way to engineer blood vessels is to use something that's usually found at a county fair.
This is a cotton candy machine. This is actually the model that I use in the lab. You can get it for about $40 or $50.
Yes, a small commercial cotton candy machine. Today, I'm talking to people like Leon Bellin, who discover things for a living. Their entire careers are about being the first to recognize the potential of a business idea, or of a musician, or of a scientific phenomenon like cotton candy. We'll talk about cultivating creativity and what happens when discoveries go wrong. Welcome to Nashville Public Radio's podcast, where we talk to some of the most interesting people in the city. This is Movers and Thinkers. I'm your host, Emily Seiner. We recorded this episode in August in front of about 60 people at WPLN's Studio C. Leon Bellin is a mechanical engineer at Vanderbilt University. He previously studied at MIT, Caltech, and Cornell. I also talked to Marcus Whitney. He's a serial entrepreneur and a leader in Nashville's technology industry who got his start waiting tables here. He taught himself to code, then worked at a number of tech companies, and then started creating his own.
I mean, I really, really don't want to work for anybody else. Really.
He's currently president and co-founder of Jumpstart Foundry, a six-year-old company that invests $100,000 in brand new healthcare startups to help them get off the ground.
Making healthcare cool is hard, and that's where all the opportunity is.
And Ann Powers, a music critic and correspondent for NPR, who is currently based in Nashville. She grew up in Seattle and spent a lot of time alone, which was a formative part of becoming a writer.
Spending time in spaces where I could discover things that perhaps I wasn't supposed to be discovering was huge.
She has since worked as a critic for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, and she's written a book with singer-songwriter Tori Amos, among others. I'm wondering, what was the first time you remember discovering a song or a band?
Well, I've been a music critic since I was in high school. First band I ever wrote about was my cousin's punk band. They were called Fred. My cousin played trombone in that band. So I guess that was my first discovery. But really, it was about that experience of just getting in a room with a band you'd never heard of and having your head blown off in the best way.
Leon, your discovery process is quite different. The non-science public, I think, thinks of it as this eureka moment. Is that at all accurate? I mean, does that ever actually happen?
Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. I think sometimes it can be an idea that you have that you think might work. And so you try it and you try it and you try it and eventually get it to work. Sometimes it can be something that you're trying to do, achieve one goal, and you actually achieve a totally different goal. You say, I want to make this thing, and you make something, and well, it's horrible for that, but it's great for this other thing that you never really expected. And that actually happens a lot. It's unpredictable.
Well, so what was the process for discovering that a cotton candy machine had useful scientific applications?
Well, so my graduate work was on tiny little fibers, about 1,000 times smaller than a human hair. And I was making tiny little channels with them and doing interesting things. And I saw this really kind of disgusting talk given by a reconstructive surgeon. It was a lunch talk. He was showing a lot of pictures that you generally probably shouldn't be showing during lunch. But what I got from that was that there was this field of tissue engineering, which I hadn't really thought very much about, and that one of the problems in this field was that you need to build blood vessels. And I thought, well, these tiny little fibers I make, they look a little bit like blood vessels, but they're actually much too small. And so I thought, well, what can I make that's a little bit larger than these tiny little fibers? And the fibers make this sort of chaotic mat. They say it's kind of like if you were to spray Silly String against the wall, or Cheese Whiz, or cotton candy. So I thought, oh, cotton candy.
So did you go into a store and see a cotton candy machine and was like, no.
I was thinking about it, I think, before I went to the store. And then I went to Target specifically to buy the cotton candy machine. And, you know, in the scale of laboratory research, this costs nothing. I mean, the equipment that we usually buy is tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So $40, why not, right? And so we tried it, and it worked the first time. And so that was kind of amazing because things generally don't work the first time. And that was the first step. And now we're trying to actually do something useful with that. And doing something useful with it actually takes a lot more effort.
For Marcus, coming up with the idea behind his healthcare accelerator, Jumpstart Foundry, was much more of an evolution.
I started having to come up with ideas for a business because for a long time I thought I was unemployable. I always was making trouble in companies until I got to Emma, like because they were small enough.
Emma is an email marketing firm that now has 45,000 clients. Not so at the time.
There was just so much to do that they would just throw a million things at me and I just go in a corner and I just do a bunch of stuff. And if I made a mistake, as long as I got like 8 out of 10 things right, it's okay. And then once Emma got big enough, I was like, I got to get out of here. And I was looking at what was going on in Silicon Valley and, you know, Boston, other cities that had like seemed to just have like an assembly line of these companies and, you know, big exits and stuff. And I was like, how the heck are they doing that? And why can't we do that here? And so that began my process really of working on the city too, you know, and trying to figure out how do we build our own assembly line.
You invest a lot of time and money into companies. How do you decide if an idea is worth investing in? You put a lot on the line.
So in the beginning, it was just like if it was a cool idea and we liked the people, we would do it. And, you know, after 5 years, we saw some of our favorite people with some of our favorite ideas totally crash and burn. And then we saw some people who had good ideas that we weren't terribly excited about be pretty successful. What we learned was that here in Nashville, surprise, there's a strong healthcare industry. And, you know, if we build companies to support the industry here, the investors here understand those companies better. They are more likely to invest in them. The companies are more likely to have a customer base or at least get real feedback in real time about, you know, what they need to do to improve their company. And for most companies, what kills you is how much life you have to live before you run out of cash, right? It's called burn rate. As long as you can outrun that day when you run out of money, you still have a company, even if you're not cash flow positive. So in Nashville, if you're building a healthcare company, you have a longer time to live.
Anne's job is also, in a way, to boost talented people. Musicians that you write about, you're not necessarily investing in them
financially.
Right. But you do have a lot of power in who you decide to write about. I mean, like you have a national audience, you could really boost someone's career. Does that power ever make you feel uncomfortable?
Used to be, say when I wrote a review for Rolling Stone back in the 90s or whatever, it might make you decide, oh, I'm not going to buy that record. You know, Anne gave Hootie and the Blowfish 1 star. Actually, wrote a very positive thing about Hootie and the Blowfish back in the 90s. But we don't have that kind of power, such as it ever was, anymore, because you can listen immediately to the music, often before I'm even hearing it. So the idea of a critic as an arbiter of taste still applies, but I think we're much more in dialogue with artists and also with fans. I guess that's a roundabout way of saying that, yes, I have some anxieties about my influence, but at the same time, I feel we're all in this together now, and I would never think I sat at the top of any hierarchies.
Surely some artists must write to you after you profile them. And
yes.
They're like, we just sold so many more records because of this.
Well, no. I mean, music critics are not what moves the music industry particularly. I think that fans have just as much influence, if not more influence. When I was living in Tuscaloosa, there's a band called St. Paul and the Broken Bones. I have a friend here, a writer named Julie Height, and she had seen them and told me, you gotta see these guys. So I went to this little bar called the Green Bar in Tuscaloosa. It holds about 40 people in the room. And I don't know if any of you have seen St. Paul, but man, see them live once and you're a fan for life. So I'm standing here in this little bar. They're playing. There are frat boys walking by, coming in, being drawn into the room, right? By the end of the set, it's gone from 40 to almost 100. Is that my discovery? Well, A, another writer friend told me to go to the show, so no. B, I'm not having any more insight than that you know, those Greeks who, like, walked in because they couldn't avoid the show. But I was lucky to be in the right place in the right time, and I was able to write about them very early for a national audience. And that helped them. And frankly, it helped me because I now am someone who can predict the future that this is a great band. But as you see, there's a lot of pieces that go into that. It's not just my pristine taste.
in order to discover these kinds of bands, Anne listens to a lot of music and goes to a lot of shows.
That's why I wear earplugs, because I've lost a lot of hearing. So,
okay, that's a corollary to my question. I read a lot of food critic writing, and what I've read is that food critics get so tired of eating out because they have to do it all the time. Do you ever get tired of listening to music?
No. I mean, no way. How could I? I will say that like when I go to South by Southwest, this huge festival in Austin every year, you know, I'm not that into like having to go see 20 bands in a night. But not on a, no. I mean, I always am ready to hear a new artist that's going to just make me cry or make me laugh or make me shake my ass. Can I say that on public radio? But, you know, that doesn't change after 30 years of doing that. That's still something that happens on a weekly basis.
You also need a certain amount of stamina as a scientific researcher. Even if you discover something big, you still need to work a really long time to see if anything can come of it. Here's Leon.
One of the things with doing work in the lab is things almost never work. That's the general state of laboratory research, is that stuff is not working. At the end of my graduate career, I was sort of very lucky to have a couple of things kind of work the first time, and that generally doesn't happen. You have to get used to a significant amount of frustration. For younger students, particularly who start this, that's one of the first things they have to learn. You know, we have students that come into the lab and they think, okay, well, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and I'm going to cure cancer. It'll take me 3 weeks. And no, that's not how it works. And most of the stuff doesn't work. And it's, you know, every couple of times you have this moment where something looks like it might be moving in the right direction. And you have to kind of just take that and say, okay, now what? You know, the class that I'm teaching right now for freshmen coming in, we're having them build these cars out of Legos. They're told to build a car that goes as fast as possible and can tow as much weight as possible. And they invariably ask me, well, how do I do it? And I say, I'm not telling you. And I tell them on the first day, you're going to fail at this several times before you get something to work. And that's not something that I think they're used to. In the long run, they really appreciate that. But they get very upset by it not working and me not telling them how to do it.
Well, so how do you get used to continual failure?
Totally the right way to put it. You kind of have to keep your eye on the big picture. But sometimes also say, okay, I've tried this and I've convinced myself it's not going to work. Sometimes you're right. And then sometimes 5 years later, someone else gets it to work and you say, oh, you know, shoot, I was, you know, I was this close to getting it to work and I gave up too soon.
What have you given up on that someone else then is able to do?
Oh, lots of things. There was one project in particular where I was making these tiny little fibers and I was making them out of a material that if you stretch it will generate a little bit of electricity. And I was trying to see if I could measure some amount of electricity that was coming out of the fibers. And I couldn't really measure anything. And I kind of convinced myself that it just wouldn't work. And so I gave up on that after about maybe 5 or 6 months. And I had 4 or 5 projects going on at the time. And then several years later, other people sort of got it to work with the same material and, you know, figured out some things. And, you know, that's fine.
How did that make you feel?
I was a little frustrated that I didn't get it to work, but I was happy that someone else got it to work. There's certainly a lot of competition. I mean, in the scientific community, like I'm sure in many communities, people will rip each other off and they'll claim, oh, I discovered this thing, when actually, no, someone else discovered it 10 years ago. You know, sometimes if someone publishes a paper that's identical to a paper I published, but, you know, the same thing 5 years later, I might send them an email and say, hey, have you seen my paper? It doesn't really accomplish anything, and maybe it makes me feel a little better. But if you focus too much on what other people are doing, it sort of detracts from what you're doing.
In Marcus's world of business, failure is also the standard, but it can be much more devastating.
The existing venture capital model is basically like if you're a great venture capital fund, you will hit 3 out of 10, you know. So you're going to fail 7 times out of 10. I'm not a typical or classic investor. I'm an entrepreneur. I worked my way to the investor side of the table because I got so sick of the way that investors treated entrepreneurs, right? I mean, like, it's part of their business model for 7 out of 10 of us to fail. That's fine for them because they're going to make up for all the failures on the upside of the wins. But like, that's 7 probably times 2, 14 founders and then their families. And it's not to say that there's nothing that gets learned in failure. And it's not to say that you can 100% avoid failure. However, that's kind of our deal at Jumpstart. Like, we kind of, we try to balance the two and understand that while the money is important, generally speaking, it's the brave people who are trying to do something that really hasn't been done before. They deserve our belief that they can all be successful. So we shoot for 100% success. So we try to cheat as much as we can.
What does that mean?
Before, we used to just like open up applications and say, oh man, these are really cool people and that's a great idea. And we're so great and awesome that, you know, our help, a little bit of money, their ingenuity, we're going to be really successful. What we've changed is we understand that you can make the best product in the world, Betamax, and still lose. So our job is not to create the best product in the world. Our job is to produce a better return for our investors than they would get elsewhere, right? So what we decided to do is we said, look, we're in Nashville. We can sit down in the office of a C-level of almost any health system here that controls collectively 55% of the for-profit hospitals in the country. And they have a lot of problems. Why don't we go talk to them for 4 months, figure out what they need and what they actually can pay for, and then let's go recruit that. And usually that's already out there. It just hasn't had the benefit of talking to the people we have had the benefit of talking to.
He says finding the right people and the right idea still applies.
It's just we have a much better understanding of who those people are and what that idea is when we start. It's kind of like going into a bar and saying, you know, I'll take anything. You know what I mean? Or going in specifically and saying, you know, I like my guy 6'4", you know, with a tight haircut, you know.
I totally thought you were talking about drinks.
No, and so we know our type, basically. Every year we know our type. And we bring 20 of them home with us.
I have to ask, because I cover healthcare occasionally, and I also cover technology, and the kind of pure technology sector is just so much more interesting. Like, it's so much easier to understand, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Uber, and healthcare is like full of acronyms and jargon. How did you get excited about that?
Making healthcare cool is hard, you know, and that's where all the opportunity is. There's a massive market. Obviously, the person who figures out how to make healthcare Apple good is going to make a million bazillion dollars, right? But it's boring, and it's not easy to attract really creative people to go do it, even though it's some of the most interesting stuff you could do. And it's some of the most meaningful stuff you can do. Like, are you trying to tell me that Facebook is more meaningful than, like, a new, more inexpensive way of measuring cardiac output and saving people's lives and detecting kind of heart disease? It's not. But no one's figured out how to make it that attractive and make it cool. So that's our whole deal. I mean, my whole company, with the exception of Vic and myself and one other person, they're all millennials. They've never worked in healthcare before. And that's how we like it. You know, we don't want existing ideas. So that's where we think all the opportunity is make it cool.
This is something Leon struggles with, too, in his field.
In order for people to understand your work and know about the discovery, you have to dumb it down significantly. Does that ever bother you?
Sometimes. I guess it bothers me because I feel like sometimes I'm saying something that's not actually true. And I want to be able, I wouldn't use the word dumb it down, but come up with analogies. And I think this is actually really important. This is something that scientists and engineers are generally really bad at, myself included, is trying to take an idea and get the general public excited by it, because the general public is, you know, paying taxes, and the taxes are used to fund us. And so it'd be nice that the general public understands why the stuff we do is so exciting and so worth funding and so important. But then sometimes if you have to twist around what you're doing to the extent that it the analogy is so bad that it's kind of absurd, well, that's not really helpful either, because then people get a very incorrect perception of what you're trying to do. And I spend a lot of time worrying about that, because every time I say, you know, this is kind of like that, and I wonder, well, is it really? Because technically this one little aspect is not exactly the same. And, you know, I don't like to be wrong. But then if you start using all sorts of jargon and acronyms and stuff like that, and that's not helpful at all either.
But just as it can be hard for the general public to understand the work in specialized fields, Anne points out the other direction can be difficult too.
I just recently saw that movie, The End of the Tour, that's about David Foster Wallace, and I think this applies to what you were saying. He and David Lipsky, the writer who's interviewing him, are talking about relating to stuff that might not be like high literary art in the opinion of certain people. And David Foster Wallace said, "Who are you to presume that that person who might not share your taste doesn't have as much depth to them, is not, you know, experiencing life in equally as complex a way as you are?" And I think all of us who become specialists and who are in communities of specialists who are competitive with each other, who are always trying to out-hip each other or out-smart each other, we can, you know, become snobs. And I'm the enemy of the snob. I mean, my favorite kind of discovery is discovering, like, why did people like Creed, you know? I went to Madison Square Garden to figure that out. And that was one of the best reviews I ever did. And why would I presume that my hipster friends, you know, were more somehow elevated above other people?
Anne says there's also a tendency to look for the new and the next, and that's pretty limiting.
In a sense, as humans living in a capitalist society, we are addicted to discovery, to the sexy thing that somehow gives us that child response that we have of like, oh, it's a shiny new thing. But that's often not the most intellectually rich or emotionally beneficial experience. Right now I'm working on something I'm writing about Jimi Hendrix. I'm from Seattle. I've been like, I was born listening to Jimi Hendrix, you know? But that doesn't mean that there isn't a lot of worth in constantly revisiting his work, constantly revisiting his recordings, constantly revisiting his story. One of the miracles of the web is that the archives are just opening wide. And you can go on the web and find Edison cylinders, music from every nation in the world. You can hear isolated tracks of the Beach Boys' harmonies. There is so much out there. Jump off social media for a minute and explore how much there is to discover and find your bliss, because there's just, it's endless.
I guess the way I think of it is it's better to discover something that has staying power. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go around and discover all sorts of great things, and no one will care about them 5 minutes later. You know, you could say, I drew this picture that no one's ever drawn before and, you know, submit it to some journal no one's ever heard of and probably convince them that it's something interesting. But does that really mean anything? Not really. And it could be that those new things are things that people maybe don't care about now, but they might care about in 5 years. But more often than not, if you value discovery for discovery's sake and you kind of lose sight of that, you lose sight of the impact, you lose sight of the meaning, then I think there's a lot of time and effort wasted.
When we opened it up to questions from the audience, a big thing that we got was, can you teach discovery, or is it just innate?
I have a question for Marcus. As an idealist person who's always worked for other people, I so admire entrepreneurs for being brave enough to take their ideas out there. Do you think the entrepreneurial spirit can be imbued into someone, or is it just something that you have?
The spirit is typically pretty natural. The spirit doesn't always align with the skill set. So the skill set is absolutely learned. And there are good entrepreneurs and there are bad entrepreneurs. That is a real thing for sure. And I wouldn't say good or bad based on kind of how successful they are, but how they do what they do. You know, an entrepreneur wants to make a connection between all the things that already exist and help something that's really, really valuable, but that people don't understand is really, really valuable to stick and make that impact, you know, over a long period of time. And also generally, they just don't want to work for anybody else. That's the other thing. I mean, I really, really don't want to work for anybody else. Really.
One of the things that I got from all of your comments is that curiosity is the thing that has brought you to the place where you are. Is there something in schooling that either thwarted that to some extent or nurtured that?
I'm a typical helicopter parent. I don't like to necessarily leave my kid alone for long periods of time to do whatever the hell she's doing on the internet or whatever. But I think for me, spending time alone in spaces where I could discover things that perhaps I wasn't supposed to be discovering was huge. For example, I grew up in Seattle in a neighborhood called Magnolia, and there was a library, public library, and I was not a very popular kid, and so I spent a lot of time after school in this library by myself. And for some reason, I became obsessed with books about mental illness and drug addiction. Now, when you're in fourth grade, you are not supposed to be reading books about mental illness and drug addiction. I don't know. I like loved this one area in the library. I loved all the books in it, and it was right next to the ghost stories books, and I got really into that. And the fact that I could do that, that I could be in that library completely alone, you know, with that freedom, allowed me to fill my mind with stories that were upsetting, that were challenging, that were inappropriate, and that made me probably become a writer. If you can find a way to let your kid be alone around culture where you feel like they're safe enough but also able to maybe encounter something that they might get surprised by, horrified by, intrigued by, I think that's a huge part.
I feel I'm very lucky that I've always had the freedom to kind of explore. I think that's a very important part of education, is not to be told. I mean, there are certain things you have to be told that, you know, this is the way the world works and this is how this works. But one of the important parts of discovery is that very often the community will say, this is the way things are done, or this is the way things are. And everyone will just basically accept it. And then someone will come around and say, well, I don't believe you, or, well, I'm going to try this different way of doing things anyways, and I know it's going to fail, or I know that you're not supposed to do it this way. And then sometimes that actually produces something really astounding. But you need to have that freedom and that kind of rebelliousness almost to kind of disregard what everyone else is telling you and go off and do your own thing. And that, I don't really know how much of that is part of the educational process these days.
So there's a little bit of a stereotype, but it's sort of a stereotype because it's true that a lot of really successful tech entrepreneurs just dropped out of college. I'm not necessarily a successful tech entrepreneur, but I did drop out of college. There's something about creating something without the instruction manual that doesn't happen enough in school. There's just way too much memorization and recitation. You know, and I understand that there are, you know, standards that the teachers and the schools have to live up to. So I understand it's, you know, it's sort of beyond the control in many, many situations. But man, as much as we can, let them figure out that getting things wrong and failing is okay. That's such, yes, a big thing. You know, they're so afraid to get anything wrong. I mean, that's a huge part of it. And you just can't discover anything and not get things wrong. You're mostly wrong.
Right.
You're
totally
mostly
agree.
Wrong.
Yeah.
This has been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Movers and Thinkers is produced by Nashville Public Radio. Thanks to our engineers, Tom Knox and Carl Peterson, to our digital guru, Mac Linebaugh, and the show's editor, Anita Bug, and the entire WPLN station that helped out. The music for the show is by a band called Discoverer that came from the Free Music Archive. We want to hear your thoughts on this podcast. Shoot us an email at movers@WPLN.org or tell us what you think on Twitter @WPLN. To find out more about the show, go to WPLN.org and click on the Movers and Thinkers box on the right side to sign up for our mailing list. I'm Emily Seiner, and this is Nashville Public Radio.